Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Don't you know we're going to have a Solartopia? This is Harvey Wasserman, Solartopia, Green Power and Wellness Show. And we are going to have at least a half hour here devoted to our wonderful, dearly beloved friend Pete Seeger, who, sorry. thought I'd be able to talk, who passed away last night, Monday night. Pete was just a force of nature. He and Toshi Seeger were married for 70 years. Pete was 94. Toshi was 91. She passed away last year, about 6 months ago, I believe. And what happened to me, I was writing last night at 3 a.m. in the morning. I had just finished a draft of a very long piece on nuclear power, as usual, very depressing piece. And I just happened to be going to Google to get some information, and I just saw the headline that Pete had passed away. He had an incredible life, and we were so blessed that he lived so long, the two of them, Pete and Toshi. Toshi was just also an incredibly fabulous human being, and the two of them lived in a wonderful home on the hillside in upstate New York, much too close to the Indian Point nuclear plants. But Pete did his part on them. I have a piece about this, about Pete and Toshi. It's at ecowatch.com, ecowatch.com. It's also at nukefree.org, on my blog there, and at freepress.org. We're honored to have this show was originally scheduled to talk about some meetings, some important meetings that took place. We have Greta with us, and Susan, who was in the meetings. And I want them to introduce themselves. I always get in trouble when I introduce people. And we've also been joined by Steve Kent, who did some interviews with Pete. And we're trying to get a hold of David Burns. So, Greta, if you don't mind, we want to talk in the beginning now, please, about Pete and his life, his impact on all of us. I won't go through the incredible resume that Pete Seeger accumulated over his 70, 80 years of activism. It's astounding. I mean, he just did so much. So let's go ahead and talk. Yes, who's speaking now?
All right, well, let me just call you back again.
Okay, I think that's David Burns.
Yeah, that sounded like David.
Okay, okay, David will call back. I guess he had a weak connection. Steve Kent,
no, okay.
You're with Susan Shapiro. And David, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, so we have Greta. You're going to be with us, and stick with us, please. Hopefully, yeah. We'll be able to talk about some nuclear stuff at the end of the show. I'm sure Pete would have wanted it that way, but I do want to. We have some great people here who knew Pete Seeger very, very well. If you don't mind, I'd like to start with David Burns. David B E R N Z. You and I were incredibly lucky enough to let Pete have Pete let us collaborate with him on the Solartopia song that opened the show. And you got a house full of people there to talk about Pete?
Yeah, well, right now I'm at my music store, believe it or not, but I'm going to go home and be with people tonight. So it's just me right now.
So let's have you speak with us, and then we'll let you go, because I don't want you speaking while you're driving. In fact, Monday I had a car accident, and I'm very conscious now of people talking while they drive. So I don't know. What can I ask you to say about Pete? You were so close to him. You did a wonderful, wonderful album called Work of the Weavers that gave a history of Pete's amazing career. And I mean, the impact that he had on the area in which you live in upstate New York was just staggering. But you, as much as anyone in the world, know the history of Pete Seeger. So tell us what you'd like to say about him, please.
Well, Harvey, as you might guess, it's impossible to encapsulate all that Pete meant to me or the community or the world in a few moments. But I would put it like this. Pete Seeger was like a very, very warm light bulb that's shedding light and warmth and making everything around him a little warmer and a little better, a little more human, and in so many ways. And that goes for the community of Beacon, New York, where he established the Sloop Club, which brought in the musicians and the festivals and the environmental awareness of the river and so forth. But it also goes for his daily interactions with people. He treated people with such gentleness and such respect, and he was always interested in what they were doing. And it didn't matter what background you were from or how much money you made. And what I should really do is just tell a very, very short story that's emblematic of how Pete functioned, and it's very recent. And if I can do that, it'll take about 30 seconds. Do I have 30 seconds for that?
You got all the time you want, David. I want to talk a little about you when you're done, so please go ahead.
Well, you know, Pete has always felt that people in this world should get along together better and try to talk and communicate even if they disagree. And he's spent a lot of time in his life marching and protesting and writing and singing for those type of ends. And recently, in Beacon, as Martin Luther King Day approached, he put out the idea that there ought to be a march right here in Beacon, similar to the marches that occurred in the 1950s and 1960s for civil rights. He said young people should understand how important it is and also how fun it is to sing together and march together for an important purpose. And he didn't want that to be lost. And he got together with the local churches and with the Sloop Club and the Southern Dutchess Coalition and got them talking to one another. And they started holding rehearsals in the church, in the local Baptist church. And a lot of people started naysaying. They said, this is a crazy idea. Marching at 9 o'clock in the morning in the middle of January in the cold, nobody's going to come to this thing. And I said to those people, maybe so, but just maybe they will, because Pete Seeger has a vision. He was always a person with incredible vision, seeing things far in the distance that other people didn't quite grasp yet. He saw a cleaner Hudson River before anyone could see it. And people laughed at him then, his left-wing friends even, some of them. They said, what, building a boat to clean a river? What are you doing? It's crazy. But it happened. And sure enough, the word got sent out about this march, and over 1,000 people showed up at that little Baptist church on January 20th, just a few weeks ago, and marched and sang, "Oh Wallace, and We Shall Overcome," and "If You Miss Me at the Back of the Bus."
They're on the radio. I'll call you back.
And it just goes to show that's how his whole life was, is making the impossible happen with humanity and with warmth and with vision. And that's about all I can say, because, you know, I'm going to miss him terribly, and I love him, and so many people loved him.
Well, David, we love you as well. I got to tell the story. Well, I got you here. I don't know how many years ago it was, but the wonderful, fabulous Connie Hogarth took me up to Pete's home, and Pete and Toshi were there. And I did have an agenda item. I wanted Pete to write a song for this vision of I had of a green-powered Earth, Solartopia, and, you know, I was very nervous about asking him. I knew him, but, you know, not all that well. I mean, I'd seen him over the years many, many times, but didn't live in Beacon. And so I just kind of shyly asked him, after he showed me his electric truck, which really blew my mind, I asked him if he would write a song for Solartopia, and he just didn't bat an eye. And I whipped out his banjo and composed this song, and then he asked me to write the words, and I'm sitting there writing these lyrics, and he kind of very gently told me that, you know, I should stick to editorial writing. and so the song went nowhere, and I really wanted it to happen. And then all of a sudden I heard that you had written these verses, these lyrics for the Solartopia song, which we used to open and close this show. And they're just perfect and just wonderful. And, David, you had many, many years with Pete. And, you're just going to have to live to be 94. And, we were so lucky that he lived as long as he did. He and Toshi, and not only did he live long, but he was in great shape. He was just up. And, I mean, you're talking about Martin Luther King Day this year, is that correct?
That's correct. And he was going to actually march, but like I said, he took ill just around January 20th. So it was sad that he couldn't attend that event. It was the first such event that he couldn't attend. Just a few weeks earlier, he had done a live concert. But in a way, it's kind of fitting because we are going to have to go on without him. And this march was emblematic of, symbolic, really, of the type of world Pete envisioned, because there were black people and white people and Hispanic people and young people and old people all marching and singing together, despite the little differences or even larger differences that we may have on a daily basis. The whole community of Beacon came together for equality on that day. It was just a little piece of the world that Pete, with his long vision, sees that we could perhaps create someday.
Well, he was such a graceful guy. I mean, first of all, I'm not sure how many people know that Pete lived in a cabin in the woods, basically. I mean, for how many years? I don't know, 50? And, he was chopping wood and doing preserves, he and Toshi.
It was about 50 years. He lived there since 1949.
Wow, that's Steve Kent, right, Steve?
Yeah.
You're in the upstate New York area, and Susan Shapiro and Greta, chime in if you like.
I'm going to have to say goodbye, by the way, Harvey. I have another interview, believe it or not, and you have some wonderful people there. I heard
all
the
right.
name. So,
well, David Burns. People should look at David's work, the work of the Weavers. And, David, I have you to thank for – we all have you to thank for the Solartopia song, which was on the Grammy-winning Tomorrow's Children album that you and Pete made possible, along with David Einbender and so many other great people from the Beacon area.
And you also made that possible, Harvey. So thank you for that song and for that
thank
idea.
You. Well, we'll hopefully do more together. And you now, we all got to live to 94 and go to Martin Luther King Day marches right up into our 90s. So thank you very much, David Burns, for being with us. And we're with you in spirit, okay? And drive carefully, please. All right. Steve Kent and Susan Shapiro and Greta, can you, Susan, you haven't been on yet. You live not far from Pete. You've been in the area. And Steve, chime in as well. You're from the area. Greta, where are you from? Where are you calling us from?
I'm from Alabama.
Okay. But you know about Pete Seeger, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. I've marched to his tune many a year.
All right. Well, is it legal in Alabama to march to Pete Seeger songs? It is now, right? Susan, we haven't heard from you yet. Steve, I hope Steve, do you have time constraints? Can you stay with us for the hour?
Sure. Well, I have to go to the same place David's going to, but I'll stay on for a while, sure.
Okay, that'd be great. That'd be great. And Susan, I know you committed to the full hour.
Yeah.
So, But tell us, Susan, a bit about Pete and your interactions with him.
Well, I remember Pete as a little child when he had the vision to start the sloop, and the sloop started going up and down the Hudson River, and he'd play in Nyack and other places along the river, and the little kids would come up to the stage, and he sang Abby Yo-Yo, and we were all mesmerized by his beautiful voice and his personality. And then in the last 10 years, I've been on the board of Clearwater and had the opportunity of working closely with him and really seeing what activism really is. His spirit, him and Toshi, their spirit, you know, is with all of us and will stay alive with all of us. And it's a great loss to all of us. He was really a hero and a national treasure to this whole country. Without him, there wouldn't be an environmental movement, I don't think. He really put a face on it, and it was his vision to build a sloop and bring it down to the Hudson and clean the Hudson through getting people down to the river so they can actually see how dirty it was. And then the Clean Water Act evolved out of a lot of his work, and he's always stuck to it, and he's always been true to his spirit of protecting the planet and the lesser people, the people with lesser access to different things. He cared deeply about environmental justice and diversity. And
forms of justice. Pete was really a social activist as well.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, you and I did a concert with him with Ani DeFranco a few years ago, you know, in NIAC with for the legal campaign on stopping the relicensing of Indian Point. It was very close to his heart, the issue of this nuclear power plant on his Hudson River, on our Hudson River.
Tell us a bit about the Clearwater. I don't know, Steve, if you're involved as well, but you've been on the board, Susan, for all these years on the Clearwater. Tell us about the Clearwater, what its work is, how it evolved.
Clearwater,
chime in if you can.
Well, the way Pete set it up, it's a really unique organization because he set it up to be like a stool with three legs. So we have education, which is we bring kids onto the sloop and down to the river and other people to learn about the river and about environmental issues. And then there's celebration, which is every year there's festivals and there's concerts. And it's the enjoyment, like David said, the enjoyment of marching, you know, the enjoyment of participating in your world and being with other people who are doing the same.
One,
and then
one of Pete's expressions for this was more with a grin than a grimace. You know, you can educate people better and get more traction for your issue, no matter how desperately important it was, if you could use, you know, humor and upbeat things and celebration.
And then his last thing was advocacy, which he really believed in environmental justice and advocacy. And he was one of the first plaintiffs in a case that we brought about thermal pollution from Indian Point. And he's fought GE and the PCBs in the river. And he fought at Storm King Mountain. They were going to turn it into an industrial site. And he's always been about advocacy. And those three prongs of clear water is what keeps it strong and healthy. And that was his vision. And he was just so far thinking, you know, ahead of his time.
Steve, what do you want to add to that about clear water? Steve, you do public relations. You helped us promote recently the delivery of our petitions to the United Nations asking for a global takeover of Fukushima.
Yeah, I did that kind of work for Clearwater, you know, way back when I first came back to the Hudson Valley in the early 90s, and I came into Pete's orbit then. You know, about Clearwater, I think Susan said it well. It's, you know, it's an environmental advocacy organization. It's also an education organization. It's also this kind of deep, you know, cultural part of the fabric of the Hudson Valley, you know, the way Pete sort of helped define folk culture. I mean, Harvey, you asked me what I wanted to say.
Please.
I was thinking about what I would say. I'm a flute player. And when I came into the orbit of Clearwater early on, I played with the booster group for Clearwater, which was called the Sloop Singers, and then worked with the New York City Labor Chorus, another project that Pete started, all these great projects. We did some, I'd founded a Martin Luther King program at a local library, and Pete did the first couple of programs with me. You know, but I thought, well, there are other people in the Valley. I got a couple of requests for radio interviews, too, and I thought, well, there are other people in the Valley who did more with Pete, and they knew him better. I tended to hang back a little bit because I could see that Pete needed space, and I wanted to give it to him. He had a million admirers, a million people. You know, you've heard him speak in interviews about how they'd get sacks of mail every day, and that, you know, he said this in many interviews, that many men, many husbands chain their wives to to the sink, and he had to chain Toshi to the desk, which he regretted, to answer all the mail. So these are some of my personal connections to Pete, and I've got little anecdotes that I could tell. But the thing is, since he died, I've discovered, and I kind of already knew this, that I'm a cliche, that so many people, have these connections that there's a way that he managed to, in this kind of non-discriminating, open-hearted way, touch so many people's lives, cut across so many boundaries, that there are literally millions of people around here and across the country and probably all over the world who feel like they knew Pete personally. Talking about his death is like talking about JFK's death. it's one of these cross-cutting, epic-making awarenesses for people who live around here, and I think all over the country and further abroad than that. Everybody feels, I've been anticipating his death for many years, wondering what this community would be like after he went. So has everybody else on my Facebook page.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about how, all right, now that he's, gone, it's kind of a surreal moment. We did anticipate it. We knew it was going to happen someday. And yet now that it's happened, we're shocked. So is everybody else on my Facebook page. And I'm left with this feeling that, now it's our turn. Now we have to, we have some nostalgia, we have some longing for the good old days when Pete was with us, but now he was woven deeply into our lives. Like Susan, I've got memories of him going back to 6 years old. But now that he's gone, it's really up to us. We're the people, right, that have to make this community and make these movements stick. And
well, it's such a gift that he lived to be 94 and Toshi 91, and you just wondered how he could do it. I mean, there came a point...
He chopped wood every day. That's how he did it. Every morning he'd wake up really early and he'd go out and chop wood. He was, he was chopping wood to Katama. His grandson said 10 days ago he was chopping wood. He was an active man with an active mind. And in so many ways, like Steve said, so many people, he touched so many people. He was like our grandfather and our father in the world, and certainly in the Hudson Valley. And it is a good question. How are we going to survive without him?
This should be a joyful moment. I mean, the guy
it
was
is.
94. He had an exemplary life. I mean, beyond what we could imagine for ourselves, and yet it's a great loss for us. But you're talking about him chopping wood. I remember being at the Beacon Sloop Club. Pete had built a stone fireplace and chimney. He built it himself. He was probably deep in his 80s at the time. And I expressed admiration for this. And Pete was never very comfortable with expressions of admiration.
He would probably hate what we're saying. I wrote this piece about him, and I kept thinking, is Pete, I hope Pete doesn't read this because he's going to get pissed off.
Right.
We're talking about Pete Seeger, who just passed away at the age of 94, talking with Steve Kent and Susan Shapiro in the upstate New York. And Greta, you're in Alabama down there. Tell us, I know it's a stretch, but tell us what your impressions are of Pete's passing down there in the heart of Dixie.
Oh, well, it is a huge loss to the world. I agree with Susan. He was a grandfather to us all. He gave us a sense of unity that we never would have had without his music to march to back in the 60s and the 70s. He gave us a sense of equality that, along with Martin Luther King and the Kennedys in those days, unified people who believed in equality and justice for all people in America, of the world, actually, and that he put that energy into the environmental movement was just so exciting for those of us who saw the bigger picture and realized that we're all on this planet together.
Well, one of the most amazing things about Pete, which was so easy to overlook because of his political commitments and his political career, which is what we focus on in general, is how incredibly talented he was. I mean, he was a musical genius. If you span the work that he did from, you know, We Shall Overcome to, you know, Kisses Sweeter Than Wine to, you know, all the way to Turn, 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 which we're going to play at the break, which I love almost beyond all songs, and, you know, and it became a rock song, for God's sakes. I mean, he was just, even just as a musician, we would be honoring him, even if he had no politics. But the idea of thinking of Pete Seeger without politics is kind of like thinking of the earth without air. Steve, how did you know him from being 6 years old?
Oh, well, you know, like just about everybody else who grew up in the Hudson Valley, he came to my school. And I can remember.
Yeah, he came to all the high schools and elementary schools. He would play all the time.
That's how he made his living during the Blacklist era.
Oh, yeah?
And he was a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant music professor. He could have been a music professor. He knew so much theory, like you were saying. He was a master musician.
And we used to talk about this. You know, Pete's father was a musicologist, and Pete went to Harvard but dropped out. He got too involved in extracurricular activities, mostly a newspaper that he put together, and he lost his scholarship. But, you know, he kind of made the deliberate choice, or just naturally gravitated, you know, not towards high culture and sort of highfalutin music, but to the authenticity of folk music. He said something about this that I can't quite recall, something about the, you know, how the energy and the drama that was in folk culture was real. It wasn't canned. And he was attracted to that and wanted it. He knew that he was kind of turning away in some ways from, you know, the intellectual world in doing this, but it was a choice that he affirmed.
Wow, I can't imagine being 6 years old and having Pete Seeger come to my school. That must have been so cool. I mean, what did he sing when he came to your school?
You know, I remember it. It was something about pirates, and there was a yo-ho chorus, and all the kids were going yo-ho out of turn. He was getting upset. He was saying, "Don't do that." I could remember getting a lecture from the principal at the assembly afterwards. I told him about this years later, and he kind of looked at me blankly. But
Abby Yo-Yo, my kids, he did Abby Yo-Yo for my kids when they were little too. We loved Abby Yo-Yo. It was the best. He would act like the giant, and he'd stomp around the stage. I mean, he was just the most amazing for little kids.
Greta, I guess he didn't come into your schools in Alabama. Can you imagine?
No, I cannot. We certainly would have loved it, if any kid would.
Well, I got to do my little quick. We're going to take a break in a minute or two. We're going to hear Turn, Turn, Turn. But Pete, when he did do the Solartopia song, they were in the middle of doing, you know, he just whipped this song up, and David Burns wrote the words. And then I had a moment where I could film it. And we came to somebody's garage. There's a small studio in somebody's garage, basically, in Beacon. And he did give us an interview. It was a great interview. I loved him. Loved talking to him so much. And then we all went into the studio, and Dar Williams came. Dar Williams, who lives also in your area, who's so wonderful. They go into the studio, and Dar had never sung the song before. I don't know if Pete had ever sung it, actually. David had probably sung it because he worked through the words. And there were about, I don't know, 10 people. There were the Rivertown kids, these young kids, and then David and his kids, and then Pete and Dar. And they sang it on the first take. It completely blew my mind. It was perfect. I mean, they were such masters. Pete was such a master at this. It was mind-boggling to me. But, you know, I think by him living so long, we got in all those years of mentoring. And I think all of us need to aspire to figure out how to live as well and as gracefully as he did.
Yeah. Well said.
Well, yeah. Okay. With that, I guess I hope you can stick with us a little more, Steve,
sure.
After the break. We're going to play Melissa there in the studio in New York. Thanks for doing this. If you'll play Turn, 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 we'll take a short break, and then we'll come right back with Steve and Susan and Greta.
To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to weep. everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to build up, a time to break down, a time to dance, a time to mourn, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together. To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time of love, a time of hate, a time of war, a time of peace, a time you may embrace, a time to refrain from embracing. To everything, turn, 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 there is a season, turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to gain, a time to lose, a time to rend, a time to sow, a time of love, a time of hate, a time of peace. I swear it's not too late. To everything, turn, 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 there is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven.
Okay, we are back with Steve and Susan, and I don't know if Greta's still with us.
Yeah.
That's a shockingly brilliant song.
Yeah. You know, and that's something should be said about that song. It's from Ecclesiastes. You know, it's biblical, as you know. Pete figured out that if he repurposed songs that were in the public domain, and a lot of musicians were doing this at the time to make money, he could make money, but he'd donate it to where the music came from. And in the case of that song, I think they donated half the proceeds, you know, after he paid his manager and his publisher and everything. But the profits went to an organization he chose in Israel, because that's where the words came from, called ICOD, which was the Israeli Committee for Arab Defense, where Israeli Jews would stand up and face the bulldozers and put their lives on the line to protect Arab communities from getting taken over.
Wow, amazing. That song has always completely blown my mind. When the Byrds did it and made it into a rock anthem, I didn't know Pete had written it. I didn't find out that Pete wrote that song until a couple of years ago, actually. And it really blew my mind that Pete Seeger had written Turn, Turn, Turn. I loved how the Byrds did it. It was always in my top 10 list of rock and roll songs, if it qualifies as a rock and roll song, I guess. And the name of the album that's from is Turn, Turn, Turn. In a little bit, we're going to hear Guantanamera. Did you ever sing that song in your schools, Steve or Susan?
Oh, yeah. Always. And we all learned Guantanamera, and We Shall Overcome. He also donates the money from that, the proceeds from that go to a group down in the South that was originally, where it was originally written. A version of it was written, but he changed it.
He called them something like public domain committees or something like this, but there was one that was established in the South to support folk music in the South that I think Bernice Reagan chairs.
Right, and Bernice Reagan, Sweet Honey in the Rock, she played it at the Muse concerts in 1979. And tell us Pete's role, if you would, in the anti-nuclear movement in the Hudson Valley. How did what he did play into the movement to shut Indian Point?
Well, you know, it's clear that without him, there wouldn't have been an anti-nuclear movement. There might not have been an environmental movement, at least not in the form that we know it now. Susan before alluded to the Storm King fight. that Pete was involved in. That was probably the first, it's credited with being the first instance of, you know, a local community with local homegrown leaders rising up to you know, fight a big utility to prevent this, you know, massive environmental damage. In this case, they wanted to hollow out a mountain and use it as a reservoir for a you know, peaker power plant.
And now, what they would have done was take water out of the river and pump it uphill in the nighttime, I guess, and then let it come down in the daytime. That's what
right.
they wanted to do.
That's right. And it's a particularly beautiful part of the Hudson River skyline. Although the mountains here are small, so but you know, Pete acknowledged that if Indian Point went, or if it meaning that if it blew up, or its isotopes leaked into the Hudson, you know, all the good environmental work that has been done in the last 40 years to clean it up wouldn't matter. He knew that it was a threat, and he put his personal authority and prestige on the line to say that Indian Point had to be shut down.
Now, the Clearwater was a big part of the anti-Indian Point movement. Isn't that right, Susan?
The Clearwater, right now in the relicensing battle, Clearwater raised a variety of contentions, one which stuck, which is the environmental justice contention, being that, you know, people without means, without cars, or prisoners, or people who can't have no access to ever evacuate were not considered. And, in fact, what was ruled, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said, you know what, you're right, they didn't consider it, but you did such a good job that we're going to use the work that Clearwater did as part of as though Entergy, the owner of Indian Point, had it in their application, which is really unusual.
Yeah, and it's a function of the National NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, that says that you can't impose disproportionate, you know, impacts on different communities. In this case, people who depend on public transportation, people who may be in an institution, you know, in a nursing home, people who don't speak English as their first language or may not speak it at all. And so it was the fact that Clearwater determined that there were disproportionate impacts and that these people would be at a huge disadvantage in the event of a nuclear accident that required evacuation. You know, it was a clear violation, but the Atomic Licensing Safety Board said, well, you're right, and you've proved the case, and we've considered the case. Therefore, that part of the law is being complied with because we've taken it into account.
Which is a totally crazy way to look at it, but we're appealing that. We're appealing that. We're in the process of that. But Clearwater has been definitely in the forefront of, you know, every battle, every part of the battle regarding Indian Point. And I think I alluded to earlier that Pete and other individuals in the Hudson Valley brought an action, which I was one of the attorneys on, due to the thermal pollution Indian Point creates in the Hudson River. Every day it sucks in billions of gallons of Hudson River water and spits it out back into the river, you know, 15 to 25 degrees hotter. It's killing the fish and the biosphere and the ecosphere in the river. And we've prevailed on that. Now we're still waiting now for the DEC to give its final ruling. It's been appealed all the way to the Supreme Court and back again, and we've prevailed and we've won. And Entergy is doing their final appeal, and the hearings will be, you know, soon for the final round. And we're just hoping Governor Cuomo and the DEC stand strong and follows the law.
Yeah, right. Well, lots of luck with that, we hope. What about the new mayor, de Blasio? Was he a Pete Seeger fan? The new mayor of New York City?
I don't know the answer to that. I once looked into, you know, his position on Indian Point and what he'd written in Q&A. Susan, do you have something
I don't
to say
know.
About that?
I know when he was younger, he was, you know, somewhat anti-nuclear, but I don't know where he stands today. He hasn't come out with a statement at this point.
I mean, he's
in time.
In his Q&A, I think he said, well, you know, we need the energy, and the plant has to be run safely, or something like this. He did not take a position on relicensing. That's not to say that he won't. Christine Quinn, you know, who he defeated in the mayoral election, was very strong on saying that Indian Point needed not to be relicensed and needed to be shut down. So I think he was differentiating himself from her.
Yeah, well maybe hope. When he realizes how little power New York City actually gets from Indian Point, he will come around.
Let's hope. Greta, are you still with us in Alabama there?
Yes, I am.
All right, good. I want to tell a story about Pete from the early anti-nuclear movement. In the 1970s, we started doing these demonstrations at Seabrook, New Hampshire. And long story short, we had from 76 to 78, we had some massive civil disobedience actions, and lots of people were arrested. In 1978, we had a situation arise where the governor of New Hampshire really went off the deep end and started threatening to kill people if they showed up at Seabrook. He was serious. This is a guy who advocated using nuclear weapons, giving nuclear weapons to the New Hampshire National Guard, presumably to attack Boston. And we wound up converting a massive civil disobedience action to a legal rally, which was allowed to be on the Seabrook site. And we really didn't know if we were going to be able to pull it off, what was going to happen, and all that stuff. And then Pete agreed to come. And he came up there, and he was joined by Jackson Brown and John Hall. And we had 20,000 people show up. It was a staggering moment to come onto the Seabrook nuclear site as it was being destroyed by the construction of this nuclear plant. And Pete Seeger came on. We had a makeshift stage with Jackson and John, and it just turned everything around. I mean, it was such a critical moment in the history of the anti-nuclear movement, and we really owe to Pete and Jackson and John the, you know, their willingness to come on to this, to the nuclear site there and sing. There is a film about it from Green Mountain Post, GMP Films, if people want to .com, or if people want to go and find it on the web. I also embedded it in the piece I wrote at ecowatch.com. So, you know, Pete just really totally, Pete and Jackson and John just totally saved us at that moment. And of course, the performance was spectacular. He was always good. I've never, ever, ever heard Pete Seeger sing when he wasn't just totally great.
In his later years, he didn't think he had much of a voice, but you're right. Even those later years' performances were always incredible, amazing.
Greta, did you ever see Pete down in Alabama?
I never did. I'm so sorry.
But he had, he's got his followers. What town are you in? He's got his followers down there, too, yeah?
Well, I'm from I'm originally from Huntsville, and I live in Scottsboro. I'm on the Tennessee River, so in the Tennessee Valley in northern Alabama.
And now let's talk a bit more about Pete, and then I do want to devote the last 10 minutes of the show to discussing some meetings you, Susan and Greta had with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So if you'll give us a wrap-up from upstate New York there, Steve Kent and Susan,
well,
then we'll play Guantanamera, and then we'll break.
Speaking about Pete and the anti-nuclear movement and Indian Point in particular, I wanted to say two things. One is, it's a little tough to tease out his activism on nukes and Indian Point from the rest of his activism because it was all of a piece. It, you know, for one thing, around Indian Point in this region, it's part of, you know, many different interlocking environmental and social justice issues. Everything from the fact that this big, you know, multinational billion-dollar company wants to build a desalination plant 3 miles away from where you know, the isotopes from Indian Point are being dumped into the river for Rockland County, even though they don't need it. The fact that they're trying to build these big, you know, pipelines to bring fracked gas through the area, and people are up in arms about that. It's all interrelated. Pete understood that Indian Point was one of the big root issues, you know, that it had to go to preserve the environmental quality of this area, and he was active on it. The other thing I wanted to say about it is that, you know, like I said earlier, more with a grin than a grimace, you know, it's a deadly earnest, you know, incredibly dangerous issue. Pete found a way to get people's toes tapping and you know, getting them singing along with songs like, I remember one called The Clockback Day, the chorus of which was, when the nuclear maniacs get the sack, that'll be the clockback day. We turn the clock back in some small way. I don't know if he wrote this one, but he sure sang it. Don't let Bernard Cohen use your Clivus Multrum toilet, et cetera. So, you know, when I am tempted to, you know, just chain myself to the fence and say, okay, you know, come take me, irradiate me. You know, I'm going to sacrifice myself, and I'm going to be angry about doing it to close this plant down. I remember Pete's spirit, that he did this and took these stances because he loved this valley and he loved everybody in it. He loved the workers, you know, he loved the ratepayers, he loved the activists, and he loved the businessmen. And he approached it in a way that let everybody feel some ownership of the outcome, and approached it in a way that's embraceable for everybody. And I will spend the rest of my life admiring and imitating what he did.
Steve Kent, a very beautiful put. How can we get a hold of you on the web, Steve?
Well, just Google my name. I'm KentCom LLC. I don't have a website, but I'm all over the internet in other ways. So just Google Steve Kent or my company, KentCom LLC.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much. Susan, do you want to add to that before we jump into Guantanamera? And then we'll join with Gretel and you to talk about your meetings at the NRC.
No, I think Steve said it very well. You know, Pete was our hero and always will be. We love him very much.
The one of the great things about Pete before we go into the song is that he really understood the importance of winning. You know, he was he had that oomph to him where it was not enough just to give the old college try. He wanted to make the change, and I mentioned earlier when I visited him, he actually had an electric pickup truck. It was the first totally electric vehicle I ever saw, actually. He had just gutted this beat-up old pickup truck and filled it with car batteries. And, you know, all he did was take it to town and back. But he understood the importance of successfully making a statement. And you know, somewhere, that thing should probably go to the Smithsonian, you know. I mean, it was just an incredible vehicle. And he just, you know, oh, yeah, here's my electric pickup truck, you know. All beat to hell, but by God, it did not burn gasoline. We've been talking with Steve Kent and Susan Shapiro and Greta from Alabama here about Pete Seeger. I want to play his Guantanamera song, Melissa, in the studio, if you would, and then we'll come back. Steve, we'll let you go. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I hope
Thank
to see you again real soon. All right, here we go with Guantanamera, one of my favorites of all time. This one comes from an album called We Shall Overcome.
Back about 60 miles from where I live, in the Hudson Valley, is a big city. And on 59th Street and 7th Avenue, the old statue of the fellow that wrote the words of this next song. Jose Marti, 1895. Yo soy un hombre sincero, de donde crecen las palmas. Yo soy un hombre sincero, de donde crecen las palmas. Y antes de morir me quiero echa mis versos del alma. Guantanamera, Guaira Guantanamera, Guantanamera, Guaira Guantanamera. No sense in me singing it all by myself. Let me teach it to you. Even if you never sang a note of Spanish, you can get those two words. Guantanamera. Repeat it. Guantanamera. Now you know half of the chorus. Guajira.
Guajira.
Now you know the whole chorus. Sing it.
Guantanamera. Guajira Guantanamera. Oh, sing it out. Mi verso es de un verde claro y de un carmín encendido. Mi verso es de un verde claro y de un carmín encendido. Mi verso es un ciervo herido que busco en el monte amparo. Guantanamera, Guantanamera. Pobres de la tierra, y
quiero yo mi suerte echar con los pobres de la tierra. Quiero yo mi suerte echar el arroyo de la sierra. Me complace más que el mar. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Oh, sing it out. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. One more time. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera.
All right, that was an incredibly wonderful Pete Seeger, passed on yesterday, Monday. To say we'll miss him is about as big an understatement as one could ever enunciate. We're with Greta Johnston and Susan Shapiro. Susan's been talking to us from upstate New York, near where Pete lives, and Greta has had her moments with Pete's music down in Alabama, as Dr. King would say. Greta, you and Susan, and we're going to proceed to biz here, as Pete would want us to do. I think he'd be embarrassed if we gave a full show just to him. And our original plan was to talk about these meetings you had. So, Greta, tell us the key points. We've only got 6 minutes here of your meetings in Washington, D.C. Well, actually, in Baltimore, in Maryland, and in Washington on the nuclear issue. I understand you met with the chairwoman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Can you tell us a bit about the issues you raised with her and what you tried to accomplish?
Yes, we were so fortunate. Gene Stone out in California and Priscilla Saw of the Coalition Against Nukes organized this for engaging directly with committee and for committee actions. And we met with three of the Nuclear Regulatory Commissioners. What we spoke about were the issues of high burn-up fuel, which I guess we're going to talk about next week. With Marvin Resnikoff, and we also spoke about something that is dear to Susan and my heart, which is monitoring. We think that we need to make radiation visible for the public
That's a very big deal. I mean, here we've had people scurrying around trying to figure out what kind of impact Fukushima is going to have on the United States, and there's no integrated monitoring system to tell us how much radiation is actually coming here or what kind it is. Is that right?
That's absolutely true, and they're passing the buck, and the EPA is passing it to the NRC, and the NRC passes it back, and they have a border. You know, we're only responsible for this, and they're only responsible for that. So we're trying to build some bridges, and I think that we had some very good meetings, both the NRC and the EPA, and up on the Hill with Senate staffers as well.
Susan, what do you think of the meetings with the – what is the chairwoman's name? Allison McFarland,
Allison,
right?
McFarland. I think she was receptive. I think it was surprising how receptive they were and to us. I don't think they hear often or they see enough of reactor community people. They don't come out to the communities very often, and it's hard for us to go to see them. It's challenging to – you have to go down, shut down to D.C. and everything. But they were somewhat receptive, and surprisingly, it's true. They are not doing any kind of real-time comprehensive monitoring, even on site. And they do a very antiquated system of quarterly averaging, which seems amazing in this day and age. And the fact is that some of the commissioners said, yeah, we'd really like to have some good monitoring ourselves, which they're in charge of it. Why don't they have it is one of the questions we're asking. And we do have to continue. It's a national question. Why don't we know what our background radiation levels are across the country so that if something happens, the public could be aware? of what's going on.
Well, this is mind-boggling, and we've only got a couple minutes left. It's mind-boggling to me that after the first commercial reactor opened in 1959 in Shippingport, Pennsylvania, and in the 55 years since, nobody has established a system of monitoring radiation from nuclear power plants, and yet they turn around and tell us these reactors are safe.
Exactly.
And the same thing with President Obama gets on national television after Fukushima and says the radiation's not going to come here and don't worry about it, it won't harm you. But we don't know. There's no system for telling us how much has actually gotten here or what it is.
Well, it's even worse than that. They rely on the operators of the plants to tell us whether there's a release. So it's a real fox watching the henhouse system. And then
But we gave them excuse me, Susan.
Yes. Go ahead.
Go ahead, because we've got to hurry.
We did give them some steps to take to make it happen. And you know, we think that this is a very real possibility. It's not a high-ticket item. The technology is in place. It is developed to the point where the monitoring the Internet and the monitoring technologies are ready for this step.
All right, very quickly now. I hope you two can join us next week again. We can do a fuller show on radiation issues. What website should people be going to? Greta, do you have a website you want to direct them to?
Yes, matrr.org.
And what does that stand for?
Mothers Against Tennessee River Radiation, and we have a page on to make radiation visible. We have several steps in that. You know, the more than the monitoring, also with dye markers for emergency releases and with public health alerts. We have weather alerts, we have smog alerts, we have pollen alerts, but we don't have radiation
quickly, Greta,
alerts.
We're out of time almost. Susan, tell us quickly your website.
Go to clearwater.org for now, or riverkeeper.org.
I'm sure you can register your love for Pete Seeger. Susan Shapiro, Greta Johnston from Alabama, Susan from New York, thank you so much. This has been the whole show is in honor of Pete Seeger. Thank you in New York, Melissa, Jason, and the crew. And we will be back next week. We'll have you two back next week if we can talk in greater detail. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, our Pete Seeger Memorial issue. Pete Toshi, we hope you're up there enjoying all this, because it's been for you. Next week we'll see you again, and we'll see you soon in Solartopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna
so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna